Right now, it is time for David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast it also next week and this weekend, and also all the time at RobinHoodRadio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. Good morning, David.
Well, hello to you. It's good to be with you.
So, you know, I was it was funny. I was watching some of the coverage on C-SPAN last night of the green platform that is being put forward by the congresswoman from New York. And, you know, in all the talk that you hear on network TV about people running for president, you never hear the name Bernie mentioned yet. But there was an interview with the congresswoman, and she was an early supporter of Bernie 2 years ago, actually during the Hillary Clinton campaign. And they asked if she still had the burn, and she said, "I never announce my endorsements until we come to the different primaries." So she still feels the burn. It's going to be interesting to see what happens if and when Bernie Sanders declares, to see what happens with the field and Joe Biden as well.
Yes, it could be a field that includes old men as well as remarkably vivacious and vital and striking newcomers like ACE, Alexandria Cortez. Of course, you're getting all those strains upon loyalty that you get when politics boils down to races. Because although, you know, constantly, you know, good journalists are protesting that they're interested more in the issues than the horse race, well, of course, it's only horse races, direct head-to-head competition, that gets politicians into the office that they want to get into, and therefore be able to carry out the policies that they've been putting in front of us. It's a horse race, and it's already getting to be rather overcrowded. Well, crowded certainly, and it will become, I'm sure, an overcrowded race. Remember, the Republicans had 16 potential candidates at one stage, serious declared candidates, and out of that very messy, overcrowded race emerged candidate Donald J. Trump.
It's interesting to look at it from from afar, to see how, you know, people are putting so much emphasis on the on things right now. There's so much time right now. It's all just basic fluff, and it's all really just wild speculation. You can look at the polls and everything like that, but everything's wild speculation now. But once again, this past couple of days, just incredible things coming out of Washington, D.C., that, as you know, an attorney general designee who doesn't want to testify and says
trying to head off a subpoena from Congress.
Yeah.
Yes, because there's already a history of people in this administration refusing to answer questions from investigating committees of the Congress. Suddenly, the acting attorney general is frightened of getting subpoenaed and wants to come to a deal. I say, well, I'll come and talk, as long as you don't use a subpoena on me. What could be behind that, I wonder? Does someone object to being forced to tell the truth? Well, we shall find out, perhaps, during today's session. At the moment, we're in a position of having an agreement. He's coming, and he would apparently have been reassured that he's not going to get subpoenaed if he doesn't answer the questions. But we'll see how it actually plays out in real time. This is one of the few occasions, I think, where actual live broadcasting does come into its own. There's nothing quite so absolutely essentially live as a congressional inquiry going on under the arc lights of television. It can become over theatrical, of course, but it does have the benefit of actually taking place before our very eyes at this very moment. And he's going to have to think on his feet and decide whether he answers the questions. And they, of course, on their part, are going to think on their feet and say, well, has it come to the crunch? And are we going to use our subpoena powers to force him to answer? And if he doesn't answer, do we then force the notion of contempt of Congress, which could, remarkably enough, in theory at least, send the acting attorney general to prison?
You know, you've got that going. And then yesterday on C-SPAN, I watched something that was most amazing, that it even got more amazing after it was over. And it was the congressional hearings on gun control and gun violence. Once the meeting started, this is the amazing part. Four out of the five Republicans on the committee left the hearing. And one of the Republicans who stayed at the hearing tried to turn it into a hearing on you don't need about guns. It's all about the wall. And two of the parents of the survivors of the Parkland High School shooting stood up and vocally interrupted the meeting. They finally quieted down. But what amazed me is that, like I said, I think there's five or six Democrats and five or six Republicans that are on this committee. All the Republicans except for one walked out right after the start, and they would come back at various times. And that shows you the feeling of the Republican caucus on gun control.
Well, absolutely. And did I, we're talking about the other issue in congressional hearing rooms yesterday, did I use the word theatrical?
Yeah.
That's the problem about, live as it happens, media coverage of our body politic. It's very, very, in principle, at least it's an excellent idea, and it really forces the participants to tackle the issues really seriously. Or alternately, it just turns everybody into a play actor. It's not exactly a fine line between those two positions, but you can see how they can oscillate between them wildly.
I guess where I got a little upset was I would have expected C-SPAN to pull back and show you the full view that, once again, most people, when they see people speaking on the floor of the House, it's in tight and close because there's hardly anybody behind them. That is understandable.
But yes.
But when you have meetings and most of the caucus leaves the meeting room, the camera should pan back and show you that and not give you the feeling that everybody is sitting there listening intently.
Well, yes, if part of the point of their excusing themselves, if that's what they did, or just leave without excusing themselves, they're making a political point, and to pull back, to widen the shot so that you see the effect of what this political protest, if that's what it is, has done, then are you playing into their hands by making the point that there's nobody there from the Republican side, or very few, or are you making the other side's point, saying, what a terrible thing they're doing, reducing this this information-based hearing and using the overseeing role of Congress just for purely party political purposes, but depending on the interpretation, what's clear is if you, as the director of that television broadcast, pull back the cameras, you are making a point, and is it a point that's sympathetic to the one side who's made its particular decision to absent itself, or are you making a point that favors the now majority? This is a question that I think everyone's going to have to confront all the time now that the power balance has swung in Congress and the Democrats are in charge.
You know, most people really don't realize what goes on the floor and how few people are in their seats when things go on. Because they don't have to be during the regular session. They can move in and out like that. But
the point about C-SPAN, of course, is that it is in a sort of client clientele kind of relationship with all the members of Congress, be it the House or the Senate. And of course, nothing pleases a member of either one of those houses better than for their constituents to have seen them in tight close-up, or else, ideally, addressing a very packed committee room or a very packed floor of the House or of the Senate. And of course, that has become the House style in C-SPAN, serving the needs of our people's representatives most of the time.
They do the best that they can with the budget they have, even though they've got the three channels now. But now I want to talk about what appears to be the instability of the United States government right now, and compare it to what's going on in Europe, in France, in Britain, in Germany. Are they similar, or are they vastly different?
Well, it's instability for sure on either side of the Atlantic. My filter, of course, is the media, and I think you'll find that there's a degree of hysteria in the media on both sides of the Atlantic. That doesn't necessarily mean that the issues that are being carried in this hysterical manner are quite the same. I mean, they're not, though there are important points of similarity. I think one of the points of similarity which tends to get buried in the urgency of the particular moment and the particular issue that's getting everybody hot under the collar. But there are enough strains of similarity to make us pause and think, and that is basically it happens on two levels: the civility or incivility of the coverage, the analysis and the debate. We see it on this side of the Atlantic with these incredible panels. You know, a word which has become terribly debased on cable television, especially when they're just rowdy free-for-alls.
I'm
we talk about that a lot here.
I'm going back to death panels, actually.
Death panels.
Remember?
Yeah, I remember death panels. Idea that the Affordable Care Act was an opportunity in the minds of its opponents to have local death panels deciding whether people are going to have the switch pulled on them. But yes, we've got panels every day, every hour of the day on cable news, and that's not so. The level of hysteria that represents is not replicated in Europe, interestingly enough.
Have you seen the Vice News that HBO carries? The Vice News
Sure.
They really do. I hate to say, they really do a good job.
In many ways, they do, yeah. What they're doing a lot of the time is turning their backs on what has become the herd mentality of mainstream media, which is all to the good.
But the question becomes, there's apparently nothing to do about the herd mentality.
Well, I think when you have networks like HBO that give time to Vice, now it started out as an hourly show at late at night at like 10 o'clock once a week, and they now give them a newscast every evening.
But you have to want to watch that. And the point is that most people have been pre-addicted. It's really appalling. And
well, that's why I and I hope other people talk about it on the air, because more people find it. Because yes, you get a slice of what you get it with the mainstream networks, but there's a whole different world of news that is out there that people just are not exposed to.
But the assumption, by the way, that everybody's interested in what they're being given on the three main cable networks and is. Faulty. And I think about this when you talk about the horse race. And in a few minutes, David, because I don't want to run out of time, but we're going to enter the conspiracy part of the show, and I can't wait. So
I can't wait either.
But the assumption that people this breaks my mind. It doesn't bend my mind, it breaks it. The assumption that people are thinking what you're saying is so rife and so wrong. And on a certain level,
I take it you're talking about the assumptions made by what I guess we have to call the mainstream media still. You mean the mainstream, the three major networks, for instance, have got a particular strain of delivery, which they think is what people want,
right?
And they never test that by offering them anything different.
God forbid, but right, no, they never do. And then you've got the cable networks that are designed to appeal to. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating how, you know. It's almost as if it's completely different languages, but perhaps the underlying assumption is, well, it's a numbers game and there aren't enough of them and there are more of us, so therefore we'll give the more of us this and we'll give the rest of them that. But
sure, the argument of numbers, you know, we are the mainstream because we are the mainstream. We have the main number, the majority numbers, and it's arguable in a very specific, much more specific, and in its stylized terms, its stylized identity. Cable news is making exactly the same argument too, with slightly a lower level of numbers, but you know, hundreds of thousands rather than millions. But they are competing with each other, and in competing with each other, they've developed their own herd mentality too, even if they take different positions, different political positions on the political spectrum. But they're still indulging in exactly the same style, if that's really the word for it, they have chosen to adopt as an expression of their form of herd mentality.
It becomes a storyline that repeats itself over and over. The networks turn to pollsters that they hire. Pollsters and also analysts go out and then come back and tell the network what they find. And if those pollsters and if those people taking and judging viewers out there want to keep their jobs with the network, they tend to go to the base of what is following the network instead of the wider, broader selection of Americans. So it's a story that's in a cycle that just can't get out
just
of.
Just like you can't get the money out of politics. But to your earlier point of how you cover things and the way you were talking about C-SPAN and pulling back or not pulling back or creating a narrative. I mean, that in the end is all it is. And I suspect.
I guess what I'm saying, all the people out there that are paid by networks to find out who's watching and why they're watching, know who they're paid for by. And I'm sorry that with the amount
of
dollars
you tell your master what your master wants to hear.
Of course,
yeah,
you have
well,
to.
Well, that's
if you want to stay employed, if it's rarely good to be the one who says, oh hey, by the way, I have said constantly in the last couple of weeks, veering towards conspiracy, if they had had me in the room when they said whoever they were, they would. I can picture the meeting. Let's put all of the information on the planet in one place. We'll call it the cloud. It will be.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously no one was sitting in the room saying, guys, are you nuts? Because. They couldn't have been, because we wouldn't have had this. Or, hey, let's give everybody all of their information on a teeny-weeny, little itsy-bitsy screen. Because that's really going to help with mind control in a positive way, not. You know, it's just... Anyway.
Well, yeah, the overall drift, well, it's not a drift, it's become a stampede to put more and more information into one small focus. Has been one of the major impulses behind the deterioration of our understanding of information in the broadcast media, certainly as a visual broadcast media more than anything.
Yeah.
If you crowd out the screen with information, what do you end up with? You end up with ignorance in the end, because the mind can't compute all that information coming at you. It all began with the Bloomberg terminal in trading rooms, and you know, if you're very concentrated and you're a specialist, then you can train your mind and your eyeballs to notice this complicated stream.
But the rest of us don't have that.
No. And of course, it spread from the specific and the specialist into a torrent of overall information of all kinds, all at once. And of course, you know, that yet again, we get another way in which to debase the transmitting of information.
And we get a way to debase the information. So this is the, we need Twilight. Oh, I was going to say we need Twilight Zone music, and Marshall gives me the 2 minute sign. Can't do this in 2 minutes.
2 minutes of the Twilight Zone. Okay.
D-D-D-D.
Where are we going with this?
We're going to Virginia. We're going to Jill Abramson.
Yes.
And we're going to, bearing in mind that Amazon builds rockets, etc., we're going to Jeff Bezos.
Uh-huh.
Because I am watching this, again, this least favorite word, narrative, take shape. And it's like, guys, if you are thinking, think bigger. And so, I don't know. Which one of those would you like to...
Jeff Bezos development is intriguing. The fact that someone who's allegedly being blackmailed stands up against the blackmailer and actually says, well, if they're threatening me with exposing embarrassing pictures of me and my Emirata, then I don't care. Here's what's let me say to the wide world, who I might be seen as frightened of having that great wide world know what it is that I'm doing in my private life. I don't care. And here is what they're threatening to expose about me. So the collapse of the effort of blackmail. It's a bold move. And it's so interesting to see that, of course, it opens up something of a sluice gate, and other people who now, not only claim but can demonstrate from citations that they can present of the threats being made to them, that they've been the object of blackmail efforts by American Media Inc. What a great name for the holding company that controls the National Enquirer. AMI representing what? National Enquirer.
What did it used to be?
Spill the beans with salacious what? Photographs.
Who used to own that?
And Bezos says, no, okay. Yes, this is what they're trying to do, and I don't care. And I'm going to point out exactly the way they work.
Well, what's interesting about it, and I'll go back to the David Letterman principle, and I don't know if you remember when David Letterman, a guy, threatened to come out and expose his affair and everything like that.
Yeah, the husband of the...
He came out, and David Letterman exposed himself before that, said he did have this affair, it was a horrible, horrible thing, but he was being blackmailed. The guy ended up getting arrested for blackmailing him,
right.
And in like 2 or 3 days, the furor was over, and David Letterman, his reputation was intact. And that's exactly what's trying to go on right now.
And what I'm saying about Jeff Bezos in this particular instance is this is only, I'm saying that this is a designed strategy, and it's not just invented by Bezos and the people he hired. That's all I'm saying.
It's a strategy that's been out there.
But it's broader because, again, the interlocking pieces that go on behind the scenes is something that people should widen their brains to.
Yes, and that's the job of every single journalist covering the story now, is to look at the examples of people who have been threatened and who have indeed stopped investigating the National Enquirer's notoriously bad and outrageous efforts at what they call journalism. These are people whose own investigations as journalists themselves have in fact been influenced by that blackmail threat. People who have caved in their efforts because their own livelihoods are at risk.
Right.
The point about blackmail is that quite often it works because people are scared and they're good and they're not bold enough to hold up against it. Bezos happens to be the richest man in the world, and he can stand up against it. the job of journalists now is to say, well, how much further does this National Enquirer type tactic go? And I think just almost instinctively, we know it'll go a lot further. And already, you know, Ronan Farrow, as a journalist, has come up saying that he and another journalist he knows was subjected to these kind of threats too, and members of the Associated Press too have been subject to the threat also, and we'll doubtless find that there are people who, you know, because they didn't really feel they had any chance, their work was affected by this blunt force effort at blackmail.
And we have to wrap it up there, but this is a huge to be continued. Everybody get their tin hats.